What's happening, family? And welcome to the podcast In the Black of My Mind. I'm your host, Al Thomas. Do me a favor and go down to the bottom of the page and click subscribe and share and tell everybody. How many bodies? Everybody's about the podcast. I'm very excited to host today's guest, a noted guitarist, played clubs as a sideman and toured worldwide. He eventually teamed up, toured, and recorded with Larry Coryell, and eventually became a Blue Note recording artist. He's produced more than 150 records in his career, 37 of which were Billboard Top 10 charting. If that wasn't enough, composing music for documentaries and film is his claim to fame. With a career spanning well over 40 years, he scored 700 films and television shows, garnering 6 Academy Award nominations and winning 2 Oscar Awards, 9 Peabody Awards, and 70 Emmys, as well as numerous other awards. His music has been hailed critically as breathtaking by the Los Angeles Times, piercingly beautiful by the New York Times, and masterful by Newsweek. He was inducted into the New England Music Hall of Fame in 2021. So it is with great pride that I welcome Brian Keene to the podcast. With my music. Welcome to the podcast, Brian Keene.
Thank you. Great to be here, Al. Thanks for inviting me.
Please, I consider it an honor and a privilege, man, for you to be here, bro. You have no idea. Before we get started, I knew you were a bad dude when I first met you with Marion and stuff years ago. And I start thinking about it, and I say, I think I met you at Scoville Studios, like wow. Around 80 or 81. Yeah. Fast forward some years later, then I would see you at Toad's Place, Marion's Christmas party, and you were always so generous with your time and talking to me and sharing things with me. And, man, I didn't realize just how bad a dude you were, man. I was like, dag, man. I'm sitting next to music royalty here. I'm like, what the heck is going on?
I view things in a different perspective. I got a lot of awards here. My kids are going to think of them as bowling trophies, you know. They'll probably sell most of them for money when I kick, you know.
No.
When you think about what's meaningful in music, I mean, you know, the number one hit of 1929 was Mammy by Al Jolson.
Wow.
In blackface.
Right.
And at the same time, Gershwin wrote Rhapsody in Blue and hardly got any notice.
Wow.
So.
Yeah. So that kind of puts things in perspective.
That puts it in perspective I've been very fortunate to go in a fairly non-competitive area, which is music for the long term. Mm-hmm. Who knew, but it actually pays in the long term. Like, you know, 40, 50 years later, this music's still being played, and right. It actually now finances my art habit, as if you will. I don't have to beg rich people for money.
Right.
Then fuck it up anyway, you know.
Right.
So, yeah. So it's a good thing, you know. I view my existence. Let me just say that I'm a squattist, which means I don't know squat in the scheme of things, and I'm pretty sure that nobody else does either. I view our collective existence as, humans are an animal on a rock that's been spinning around one in some 20 trillion stars for its entire existence, which is about 200,000 years. And we've gotten a little more accomplished than roasting meat, but it's we're still pretty primitive, and we, you know, the evidence of that is, you know, who we elected president, you know, I mean, it's, wow. You know, it's just, you know, we don't seem to evolve past certain state, you know, we can't get past this idea. For instance, like, you know, we have this idea that there's winners and losers, right? They have that in show business too. You know, if you win the award, right?
Right.
A lot of awards. They miss the point that we live in an ecosystem. We don't. And if you lived in a real ecosystem, right? If the predator was unrestricted, they would destroy the ecosystem.
Totally. You're right. Right.
And that's the sort of, you know, we give praise to these symbols of extreme absurd imbalance, you know, where, you know, some daddy's boy, you know, grows up without any kind of restrictions or learning what hard work or morality or, you know, any of this stuff.
Right.
And we adore him simply because he was born with all these advantages.
Right.
And yet the same person is talking about DEI hires. I mean, you know,
exactly.
It's just incredibly stupid. Yeah. You know, the way people think is that they don't think, you know, they get into this herd mentality. And the same thing is true of music, you know?
Yes, definitely.
You know, my view of things is that music is a universal language, and we can say with what we, you know, feel is important to say with that language. And some people are ready to hear it, and other people will never be ready to hear it.
Right. Right.
And I don't have control over that. You know, the idea of control. I think of that. You know, we're spinning around that one in 20 trillion stars. I don't think there's a lot of control that we have. I don't think that we're the center of the universe
at all.
and I think that, you know, the best to, you know, my grandfather's told me there was three types of mortality, you know, immortality is one is you could have children, you know, the biological types that almost anybody could do. Another was you could do something great and be remembered for you know what that great thing is. Although, you know, even the Julius Caesar, who was the emperor of all of Rome, is mostly thought of as a type of salad dressing today, right?
Yeah, right,
and it's not
right,
even right. named after that Julius Caesar.
Right,
either.
Exactly.
So I think that's kind of like, you know, having the largest grain of sand on an infinite beach, you know. And then the third type of immortality that my grandfather talked about, which is the most interesting of them, which is that you can pass on information and you can pass on your experience and what you've learned. And that's how we evolve, or how we should evolve as a species. Right. So pass that on and learn, you know, contribute to the evolution of those who come after you. I mean, I don't think that a lot of us think about like how we got here and the incredibly unlikely series of events, the miracle really of our existence.
Right, right.
You know, we just live our lives and think what's on TV and, you know, what's in the news and, you know, what's the latest trend of whatever, you know, that they're selling us. All that stuff is meaningless compared to existence.
Truly.
All of the win or loser stuff is meaningless compared to that we get to miraculously exist in this ecosystem in the age of heat and air conditioning, you know, and machines that can make incredible music. So, you know, my general attitude about things these days is one of gratitude. You know, and that's basically, Yes, I mean, I recognize there's lots of problems in the world, and I do what I can, but I know that whatever I can is going to be, you know, about as effective as you know, trying to get to Mars, you know, so.
But what you do, you know, I mean, you've made an impact where you are and stuff. And if more people would take the initiative to make an impact where they are, we'd be a lot further along in the game than we are right now.
That's true.
You know,
and the other thing that was really interesting about my job, you know, I started out in 1981 when you saw me in Scoville's. Mm-hmm. That brought back some memories. Gary Scoville, by the way, was my neighbor across the street growing up. I knew him since I was 5 years old.
Oh, wow.
And you wouldn't like his politics these days, but he was sort of a grease monkey who didn't have any other idea what he wanted to do. His father inherited some money, so he decided to have a recording studio. And it was like an incredible benefit to me because I started out making a record with Larry Coryell there. I had a duo with Larry Coryell.
Okay.
And we were working on some, you know, I did like vanity demos, you know, that were horrible. You know? And we're talking like when I was in my 20s, you know.
Okay.
And stoned every minute of every day.
Of course, that's and, par for the cause.
Yeah, you know, I actually ended up having to get sober to keep a job touring. Wow. If you can imagine being that bad. And I thought the important thing was to keep the job, but it turned out that the important thing was to get sober.
So, you know, now and then I have to apologize then because I am sure I contributed to that because
I was the worst ever. I mean, you know, ask Marion.
Yeah.
But, you know, what ended up happening was I was working in Scoville Studio when a husband and wife came in to do a film. One of those horrible films they make you watch when it rains during recess when you're a kid, you know.
Yeah.
Every day, Bobby's dad goes to work. It's called a commute. So, you know, this one was about taking care of your teeth.
Okay.
And I was sitting with Gary, actually, when they walked in, and they said, do you guys do film? And we knew that neither one of us had ever done anything with film. And we looked at each other and said, sure.
Of course.
And so he had written this dippy song about taking care of your teeth. You know, I put a band of really good players. In fact, I think Joey Melotti was in the band.
Okay.
Who plays with Marion and in New Haven, all that.
Yeah.
We did the song about the teeth. And they loved it. And then they came in with like sort of bad Jimmy Buffett kind of songs about shrimp boats and things like that.
Oh, no.
And, you know, we furthered the relationship. You know, we did those things, even in between touring with Larry Coryell in a duo, which is what I was doing. Or I was touring with Eddie Gomez, the bass player for Bill Evans as well.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
So, you know, with those things, what happened was they were on an assignment with their cameras, which in those days was before computers, before cell phones, right? Mm-hmm. And they were big, huge things with big reels of films, right? That they shot movies on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And not everybody had them in their suitcase, you know. They were a separate suitcase for all that, right?
Right, right.
Couple of suitcases.
You're purposeful when you walked out with something like
that.
Yeah.
So they're in Key West, Florida, doing some assignment, you know, some new kids film probably. And they notice these scruffy guys coming off of boats, and they start filming them. And it turns out they're the only film account of the Mariel boat lift in 1980. And
Mariel boat lift, I'm pleased.
Cuban Castro was criticized by Carter over having political prisoners in, you know, this prison. So, okay, you want our prisoners? And he sent actual criminals on boats to Florida.
Wow. Okay.
You want our prisoners? Go. Yeah, here you go. You know, so, you know, Castro was always, you know, like this to the United States, you know, he really had a lot of balls actually. You know, so they did a documentary about the Mariel boat lift. They actually went to Cuba. They brought me a cigar from Castro's desk, which I was going to smoke. And then I heard that the CIA regularly poisoned those cigars. So
I just No, you might want to just keep that as a memento.
So at any rate, they make this documentary, and there was no such thing as composing music to documentaries back then, in 1980. There wasn't any such thing. And they said, well, what do we do about music? And they said, well, let's get the teeth guy, you know? I did this music for this documentary. And I had worked with Arturo Sandoval and a couple other, you know, Cuban musicians in my jazz, you know, goings on. And so I put together a good, you know, good soundtrack for the thing. Not knowing anything of what I was doing, you know, they had like guys like singing on the boat in Spanish. And I put some like hopeful chords, like with strings, like a synthesizer behind it that had never been done before.
Oh, wow.
But I didn't. It just seemed like the right thing to do. It made it more powerful.
Hey, this is Marian Meadows, and you're listening to and watching In the Black of My Mind podcast.
We're done with it. Lo and behold, the film gets nominated for Academy Award. And that was the very first documentary I ever did. It was nominated for Academy Award. And the very next year, HBO, Showtime, Bravo, A&E, all these cable stations started coming out needing content, right? And I did a couple more really big documentaries. I was suddenly the guy, the composer for, you know, for documentaries.
Okay.
I never tried to be that that person, but there I was, you know. And that's the way, you know, the business is. They sort of peg you for something. And that's how they want to promote you, right?
Right, right.
So I'm suddenly, I go from a jazz guitarist of some prominence to being the documentary guy, you know, the John Williams of the documentary, as the Hollywood Reporter called me.
Okay.
And I did the Chimps movie with Jane Goodall.
Jane Goodall, yeah.
And I did the Burns movies, and, you know, and suddenly I'm the guy. What was really interesting about that is I eventually got my dream accomplished after 20 years of being a road musician, and I got signed to Blue Note Records, which is the ultimate for a jazz artist, with capital Blue Note. And but they wanted smooth jazz. They wanted me to be Earl Clue II, you know? And at the time, I was doing the first primetime documentary series on national television on ABC called Turning Point. It was on ABC. This, you know, music in the news was a brand new thing, and we were experimenting of what it should be. I mean, because it's a tremendous amount of responsibility. You know, I can make anyone into a hero or a clown by how I score the music behind them. Right. That's what music in this kind of thing is it affects how you feel about certain things. So now, I'm in front of every week. This is the old days of TV. So every week we have 30 million viewers. 30 million. Okay. Wow. That's like Super Bowl numbers.
Yeah,
today.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But back then, that was normal for primetime TV. And it's a popular show, you know. So I'm thinking, am I ever going to reach 30 million people being Earl Clue II?
No.
No. And I'm going to play it every...
Unless you play at the Super Bowl.
I'm going to play like every Toad's Place in like Akron, Ohio, or Lexington, Kentucky, or whatever, you know? And I've been doing that for 20 years, and I knew what that was. And I had kids. at that point. I had my two sons.
Right.
And I thought, you know what? I got to get out of this. I got to get out of this deal. And yet I signed this big deal and my record went to number one, like right out of the gate.
Wow.
So I said, well, how the hell am I going to get out of this? And on top of that, I'm starting to, the soundtracks, one of the soundtracks from one of my 80s movies of all things, Suleiman the Magnificent, which when I got the call, I thought it was a comedy, because who would call themselves Suleiman the Magnificent? But, you know, it turned out to be the emperor of, you know, of the equivalent of Caesar of the Ottoman Empire, right? And there was a big art program with the Metropolitan Museum of Art and National Gallery and the Republic of Turkey and all this stuff. And I found myself in this, like, way over my head, stuff I knew nothing about, you know.
Wow.
And again, you know, this is one of these things where, you know, I had done some guitar tracks for this producer, Arif Mardin, who was very successful and from Turkey with Atlantic Records. He had done the Bee Gees and Aretha Franklin. I call up Arif and I said, you know, you got to help me out here. You must know somebody from Turkey that does Turkish music, you know, because I was going to these professors who would, you know, be in some prestigious university and they wouldn't know shit about the music. You know, they were in the Ottoman Empire, they would have played it like this. You know, and you're going, and so finally, Arif says, I know nobody, you know. And I'm like, oh man, I'm really screwed on this.
Wow.
And he calls back 2 weeks later and says that he was a very wealthy guy at the time. Hmm. His cooks in New York go to a belly dancing dive in Hell's Kitchen called Fozzle's. And maybe I should check that out. And so I sent a guitar student, you know, for like 2 or 3 weeks to listen to belly dancing music at this club, right? He comes back with an album and these guys are right off the boat. They have this, you know, like a vest and the big collars and the curly slippers and all that.
Right.
And it was called Farouk and the Sultans. And the record was, you know, beyond horribly produced, but I could tell that the player had something going, you know. And I went down and caught this guy. He didn't speak any English. I didn't speak any Turkish, but the club owner spoke both languages and translated for us. And the music spoke the language. And somehow we communicated enough to go to get, you know, ideas that would work for the film, right? And the other great thing about a musician is a great musician doesn't exist in a vacuum. You know, they know other great musicians,
right?
And so once you get connected, you know, like the Middle Eastern musicians are from countries that are at war with each other at the Middle East, but over here, they're considered towel heads by bigots and they play at each other's weddings, you know, so that all the great people from like Armenia and Turkey and Greece and Egypt, and they all know each other, right? They all, they're all part of the same community in a way. They're immigrant community in the United States. And so I got this great group of musicians and there were things about the music that I couldn't, that had never been done. All that music was played. It was like kind of like Irish music where everybody plays in unison all the time. You know what I mean? You know, I thought, well, this is boring. You know, this is not going to move very much. I want to be able to emote, you know, for the film. I want to show I mean, some of the artwork was just absolutely drop dead gorgeous. If you ever been to Istanbul, it's a place to put on your, calendar.
Yeah, because it's definitely on the bucket
list.
It's
an amazing, amazing place. But, you know, so they had shots of this, you know, the Palace at Topkapi and the Hagia Sophia, which is amazing. So I wanted to have, you know, sort of music that spoke to that glory and not simply the traditional Islamic version of spirituality. I wanted to relate to a Western audience, right? Because that's what this was for. It was a tour of Middle Eastern culture to enlighten a Western audience. So I put strings with that and other kinds. I sort of orchestrated it in a way that never been done before.
Wow.
Not because I knew what I was doing, but because I was trying to make the film better, you know?
Right.
And it just went huge in Turkey. Today, that soundtrack, like every cut on it has got, you know, 15, 20 million hits on it, you know? And you don't think about these things because you don't live in Kurdistan or whatever.
Right.
You know,
and you're also not going to get 15 million hits on.
You're not streaming music from Radio Islam, you know. So that, you know, so that there you go. So this is how the thing evolved. I became a big world music producer because of soundtracks like that. And I worked with Linda Ronstadt doing her Mexican music, and Van Morrison doing Irish music, and the Chieftains, Ladysmith Black Mambazo and doing African music, so you know that opened up a whole other world. So with all this stuff, I'm thinking, okay, I can't get sucked into being Earl Clough the Second contract, right? So I think, well, how do you get out of this deal? And I thought, I know, you create art. They'd drop you in a heartbeat if they think they can't sell it, right?
Right.
So we, you know, I got together with some of the best musicians in New York, like, you know, Michael Brecker and Victor Bailey and Rodney Holmes on drums and like really great players. And we made the Bebop Headbangers from Outer Space. We called the record Attack of the Human Brain. And it worked. They dropped me.
Wow.
And then they couldn't sue me. They got really pissed about 6 months later when I produced a hit record for somebody else. But, you know, it was done by then. And I felt bad about doing it because they're really nice guys. And Bruce Lundvall was a really good guy.
He
was a friend of Miles and all that, and Michael Cascuno was there. He's a really good guy. But, you know, I would have been trapped.
Right.
And that's the thing about fame, is that, you know, if you're famous, let's say you're the Beach Boys, right? Then you're condemned to playing fun, fun, fun till your daddy takes the keyboard away. It's, you can't get out of it, right? The public condemns you. The public has said, we paid to hear this, and this is what we want to hear. And that's one of the things that holds us back musically, is that the public is uncomfortable with new. They they like, you know, what they're used to. And, music is an individual thing. It's a universal language, but it's made by individuals, consumed by individuals. And, there are artists, you know, that, like the Partridge Family or Britney Spears or whatever, or Whitesnake, that, you know, sell millions and are completely forgotten 5 years later.
Oh, yeah.
And there are others that can't get arrested while they're living, and their music lives for centuries. So what differentiates that? In my view, what differentiates is the truth in what's trying to be communicated in the music. And so that's what I spend my time doing these days. I don't do much work for others. I did the 4-hour thing about Dante. It's a 700-year-old story, which is really sort of an amazing parable of the human condition. Written by an Italian poet in exile from Florence in 1300, and still one of the greatest literary works in human history.
Wow.
And so I figure if it's been around 700 years, it's probably a good thing to work on.
Yeah, it's going to be around for a little while.
It's going to be around for a little while. So that was a Burns project, and we did a 4-hour history. It was a great excuse for him to go to Italy for 6 years and film.
Oh, wow. Years?
6 years, yeah.
Wow.
I mean, off and on.
Right.
Yeah, he had rich people paying him to go to fly to Italy. It's not a bad deal.
No. Nice work if you can get it.
Yeah. So Anyway, I've gone on now for an interminable amount of time on your first question, so you better ask another one.
Bro, I'm sitting here with my mouth open like, wow, wow.
Hi, this is Artie Dixon, and you're watching In the Black of My Mind with my brother Al Thomas.
Larry Coryell, how did you guys meet, and how did you start doing the duet?
I actually met Larry through Gary Scoville. Gary Scoville was painting a house, okay, in Wilton. And the woman who lived in the house was divorced from her husband, and she was very hot, and she was a good singer, actually. And she was working out in her leotards with Larry's wife, Julie Coryell, and he was staring in the window. At any rate, he ended up dating the woman who owned the house. And he goes to the wife, you know, to Julie Coryell, hey, I know this guy's a great guitar player. You should meet him sometime. And she said, well, just give him a call. She gave the number. And so he gave it to me, and I called him up, and I said, you know, I might have made an excuse about taking a lesson or something. I was 10 years younger. And certainly nowhere near as established, you know, at that time. He was like the godfather of fusion. And, you know, I went over there and I broke out some, you know, some killer weed and played him and play, you know, jammed with him and then played an original tune. And he just like, you know, he couldn't believe the original tune, right. You know, and she came out down the hall in dressed only in a towel and dropped it stark naked, says, oops. And I was like, man, this is a weird house.
Wow.
Yeah. But at any rate, that's how we met. And, then he invited me to play at the Village Gate. He had heard me play with Eddie Gomez and Jeremy Steig, who was a flute player. And he invited me to play with him at the Village Gate, and then that went really well. And then we played at Blues Alley in Washington, D.C. As a duo. And that was an interesting gig because we were both getting high at that time. And we go down to Blues Alley, and we go out to do this duo gig, and we had rehearsed for. And we're out there on the first song, and he walks off the stage. He had forgot to take a piss, you know. And I stuck there playing solo, like wigging it for like 5 minutes, you know. What? So, well, this is, you know, trial by fire.
Right.
And then we got like a great reception at the end of the night. We had like a, you know, encores and all that stuff. And we're all pumped up on coke, you know. And we're like, hey, I had a gig the next night. I you know, it was like just a club gig, but it was, you know, it was a gig that I was going to make. I said, hey, let's go back tonight, you know. Yeah, let's go back tonight. And we started to drive from Washington, D.C., starting at like 1 or 2 in the morning, you know. And we were all piped up on coke, and we lasted for about an hour, and then we were driving like 5 minutes each and sleeping at five. I don't even remember if I made the gig the next night.
Wow.
Because I was in such tough shape. But,
right.
This is the kind of thing that, you know, younger, stupid people do.
Yeah.
And that's how we met.
Time. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Wow. And you, I'm sorry. The trumpet player that, from Cuba, you mentioned.
Arto Sandoval?
Yeah. How did you, you said you had played
jazz
with him
festival.
Prior to.
Jazz. Oh. You know, we used to, I met a lot of people in jazz festivals because, you know, you'd go, you play, I played that duo with Larry, and that was a convenient format because, you know, two acoustic guitars, it was easy to put on in between bigger setups. You know what I mean? So they'd draw the curtain and they'd be changing the stuff behind us, and we'd go out in front and play two acoustic guitars at these jazz festivals. And so I met almost everybody doing that stuff. You know, I would go to Helsinki and We had a we went to Israel a number of times in the early 80s. And that was interesting because it wasn't. I went back to Israel on a tour in 2019. I stopped playing altogether live except for a few charity events at Christmas time and that kind of thing, like, you know, with Marion's thing. I stopped playing after 95. I had been invited to play in Greece, and you know, it was actually from one of those Middle Eastern recordings. And we had no idea in those days. You wouldn't have any idea of how popular you were in a place like that, you know, because there was no interaction of the business or communication. So sure, it'd be an interesting thing to do. So we took a band to Greece. And we get off the plane, and everybody's looking at me. I'm thinking, did I spill some shit on my shirt? What happened? And we had sold out the Acropolis in 2 hours. We were like the Kenny G of Greece. Wow. And so that was the end of it. You know, I said, okay, now it's getting a little out of control here. I'm not a Middle Eastern artist. And I actually forced the record label to sign one of the Middle Eastern musicians that I use prominently on those records. Who was working in a raincoat factory in Rochester, New York, when he wasn't playing belly dancing gigs. And now he's, he's forever grateful because now he's a big international star and he lives in Turkey. Finally, he's moved back there. That's the way it was back then, you know? You know, I what happened was when Larry died in 2017, the family asked me to do some tribute gigs because, you know, we were known for having played together and all that. And so suddenly I'm on stage with, like, you know, Bernard Purdy and, you know, like these incredible players who never stopped playing.
Right.
And I'm thinking, oh, man, you know. my chops aren't up to this, but you know what happens when you're composing nonstop. I mean, it was just like a music factory here for years. Your mind is musically active. So you're like sort of in this compositional mode. And I was like sort of composing more than anybody I knew. So I would sort of spontaneously compose. And it just came back like riding a bicycle, you know, and people responded like really, really positively to that.
Nice.
And so I did a concert at Carnegie Hall in 2018 and with this Middle Eastern guy that I had made a star, you know, because they had like a world music sort of festival and they wanted us to do a reunion concert. And it sold out. And I was like stunned, you know, I was like, out for like, you know, 25 years and it's sold out.
And you sold out Carnegie Hall. Nice.
It sold out Carnegie Hall. And then we went on a European and Middle Eastern tour in 2019 and all those states sold out. And then, and I was almost back to my old chop level because, you know, it's really hard stuff to play because you have to, you know, play incredible speeds in Middle Eastern modes and improvise in that world. And it's in like 7/8 or, you know,
I was getting ready to say, yeah, there's crazy time signatures.
So, you know, but then COVID hit. So, you know, I was like, so I'm back to just doing like the occasional charity gig with Marianne or with Artie and his fundraiser and you know, that kind of thing. I do a few things in New York and, you know, the general area.
Now you're from a musical family, are you not?
My mother was an avant-garde composer. I mean, really avant-garde. As a matter of fact, there's a Scoville story. I bought her studio time when it was pretty expensive. And I went on the road with Larry for the weekend. She came in to use the studio time. And when I came back, you know, Jeff Jones, this big engineer that was working with Gary, and Gary are both looking at me like, what the fuck? You know? I said, oh no, what'd she do? And she had brought in Siamese cats in heat, locked them in a booth, and so they would howl at each other.
Then
manipulated the sounds with tape speeds and echoplexes, and then sang to it.
Wow. I would love to hear that.
Well, oh, you know, goodness. I play it whenever I'm describing how crazy my family is. Uh-huh. You know, I'll play that and read one of my brother's dissertations of, you know, he's bipolar. Mm-hmm. And we have both, you know, passion and craziness in my family. My father was an Irish tenor in the John McCormick sort of very sort of almost corny but beautiful lyrical, beautiful voice. And he was successful in business, but he was a Jesuit and he believed in giving service. So he was successful in philanthropy that raised money for philanthropic causes. So, for instance, he served as the treasurer of the United Negro College Fund for 12 years. Mm-hmm. And he has one of these rare awards that only he and like Michael Jackson have.
Oh, wow.
For raising all this money for the United Negro College Fund. Mm-hmm. He also established the Common Fund, which is a fund with like $40 billion under management or something like that.
Wow.
The betterment of higher education in America. Mm-hmm. And he knew everybody, you know. He used to be a Republican, and I remember sitting around with him and Art Laffer, who wrote Supply Side Economics, and mm-hmm. he's like the trickle-down guy, you know, and listening to this bullshit and saying, it's never going to work. There's no free lunch, you know.
Right.
What do you know? You're a musician, you know. My father had to admit that I was right about it. And he became a Democrat after Reagan for the rest of his life, actually.
Wow.
And he also gave back to me because in 2000, when the record industry collapsed from Napster, which is an interesting story in itself, basically, I lost, you know, 3/4 of my income, because that was the easy income, because you were producing, you didn't have to be there all the time. You just sort of guide the project to be good and hire good people.
Right.
And, all of a sudden all I left was the film work, you know, and that's pretty labor intensive. I mean, you got to do all that shit yourself, you know,
right.
It takes a long time. So I said, you know, maybe you better teach me about this investing stuff, you know, because I never had any interest. I always made more money than my dad, actually, because he would take, you know, a stipend for running a nonprofit organization, but he didn't profit off of it personally until he retired. And then he served on all these for-profit boards and they paid him in stock because he had a golden parachute from the charity work.
Mm-hmm.
And he became pretty wealthy in his last 10 years or something. And then he married a second wife and she took care of it for him. So he didn't end up. Anyway.
Oh, wow.
That's the way it is. You know.
Wow.
God bless the child that's got his own. It didn't involve me. You know, I had to be the estate person, but, you know, it didn't involve me.
Hey, everybody, it's your girl, Cece Peniston. And finally, you're watching In the Black of My Mind podcast with Al Thomas.
I just roll with what happens, you know. In my work, I tend to just ask one question. How can this be better? The hard part is making it better.
Doing
the work to make it better.
Right.
You know, but analyzing how it can be better is also important, you know.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely.
And that's true of anything you do. It's not true just music, you know. It's true of anything you do. How can this be better? That's the best question to ask.
Right. Yeah, no doubt.
So
now you were born in, I was reading somewhere, you were born in Philly?
I was born in Philly, yeah, in Jefferson. Yeah. My grandfather was a doctor there. Mm. My parents met at UPenn. Mm. I was the first of three. Mm. So they were still in their college town when she got pregnant. I was born in the Jefferson Hospital in Philly.
Okay. And so when did
then
you...
we moved to Brooklyn, and we moved to the Berkshires, and we moved to Westport, Connecticut in 1957 or 58. Mm-hmm. And my father bought a three-bedroom house in a neighborhood where all the houses were the same, you know, like they're all split level 1950s, like a Levittown sort of, they don't have those neighborhoods anymore. Mm. In fact, that old neighborhood, all the houses have been torn down and they built monstrosities in their place, and all the houses look the same again, except for now they cost like, you know, $2.5 million, $4.5 million.
Right.
But when my father bought that house, he bought the house for $22,000.
Wow.
So I was middle class in Westport, if you can believe it or not. Westport wasn't Westport of today. It was a diverse community back then, not racially diverse.
Right.
I mean, you know, we had like two people that were of different ethnic, you know, two non-whites in the town, you know, that kind of thing.
Economically diverse.
It was economically diverse. Mm. And there were a lot of immigrants, a lot of Italian immigrants who families worked on the railroad, you know, the New Haven line, and settled in Westport by the railroad tracks. And so, you know, it was a different place back then. And it's still a fairly enlightened place as places go. I mean, artistically enlightened. It's the Playhouse. It's got Levitt Pavilion. And, you know, it's got a vibrant arts community. I mean, when I was living there, Paul Newman was there. Betty Davis was there. John Hammond, who discovered, you know, Billie Holiday and Bob Dylan and Bruce Springsteen. For Columbia Records, lived in Weston, the next town over. Keith Richards still lives in Weston, the next town over. Mm. Ashford and Simpson moved to town. Mm. You know, I mean, anyway, it's changed a lot, but it's not all bad. There is still, like, if you go to a four-way stop sign, there's no light, you know, you could take your life into your hands there, because all these women are entitled in their big SUVs, and they just don't wait for anybody, you know. Right. I'm from Westport.
Right. Wow.
But, you know, for me, I bought a horse farm in Newtown. Mm. That I was going to build a world-class studio. It had several barns in it, and I had hired the architect, John Stork, who did Electric Ladyland at Bearsville and a bunch of places like that. Mm. And I was in mid-construction when the record industry collapsed in 2000. So I ended up going back to my starter house in Monroe and buying and selling that place, tearing this whole studio down, actually.
Wow.
Because who's going to want a 6,000 square foot studio, you know?
Right.
Within sight of a big manor house, you know. So I tore the whole thing down and bought a different place. It's the highest point in Newtown. I got divorced, and I still own the place. I bought my ex and ex another house, and I've got the starter place that I bought in the, like, around Scoville days, right? Mm-hmm. When I was working with Larry Coryell. And it's in Monroe. It's just a shitty little ranch, but we've, you know, sort of renovated it as a studio. It was a round the clock music factory when we renovated it in 2003. And then I moved into it after I got divorced. You know, it was sort of a guy's hang, you know, it was like the type of place where the maids would refuse to work here. You know, it wasn't good. so,
wow. Okay.
So, you know, we just worked around the clock here. All the bedrooms were edit rooms or offices. And, you know, we were just doing music around the clock, cranking it out, like an orchestral score every 2 weeks, especially when we were doing all that HBO stuff.
Oh, right, right.
Then I retired in 2010, and I lasted a year. And I found that I couldn't play golf in Florida and go to Meatloaf Mondays and feel satisfied. And I said, well, screw this. And I went back to work with Barry Levinson for a couple of years, the director of Rain Man and a bunch of other movies, Academy Award. Great guy to work with. And after that, I put my big catalog of music into a library, a computer searchable library, and leased it to all the big major entertainment companies who didn't want to pay me to buy the publishing back. You know, now they're paying me every year to license the music that I own. And it's been going on for the last 15 years, and it becomes a source of funding, you know, symphonies. I did the 75th anniversary of the American Ballet Theater. I've done some things like that, you know, that are sort of really artsy that no one would ever pay for. You know, only rich people that would, you know, would grant you, and then you'd have to do what they want and so on.
Right, right.
So, you know, it's been good. It's been, you know, this been going on now for 15 years or something, and I just do the music I feel like doing, you know. And I help out friends a lot, you know. I let them use the studio, or I'll do guitar tracks on somebody's record. I just did a guitar track on Marion's record. I didn't have to get paid for it, you know. I just did it, you know.
Right.
So that's what's good about it.
How many songs in your catalog now?
Well, this is going to sound astonishing, but 19,000.
Ooh.
Yeah. Ooh. It's because, you know, they're cues. And so, like, if you do a movie, there's 35 cues in an hour, generally speaking. Okay. So they're short little pieces of music that they put, they're different moods, right? And a lot of them have the same theme, but they have different moods for the scene with the same theme, because you're... You know, the theme is like a Pavlovian bell that says, it's okay, you're talking about this concept or this character. So you can track it through the movie. It actually helps subliminally identify the structure of the movie to the viewer. And that's why the loss of these melodies is kind of mystifying to me in modern composing.
Oh, man.
But
that's an understatement.
Yeah. But, you know, it's... Then you take those melodies and you adapt them to the mood that's required. You know, I mean, the idea is to be invisible. I mean, I've had people go, oh, I love that movie. I didn't even realize there was music in it. And actually, that's a compliment, because it means you're making them feel what you need to make them feel.
Right.
And you're not competing with the movie. Right. They're focused on the movie. So it's kind of a thankless job in some respects, but it's also an incredibly powerful job, because you're reaching millions of people at a time and affecting the way they feel about things. And so, you know, I've always viewed that as a pretty awesome responsibility, and also an awesome opportunity to try to, you know, get people to move in a more spiritual and emotionally holistic direction, you know?
You know, I remember talking to you once, and Marion's Christmas Party again, and you're saying that, you said, I had a good year, man. You said you did 9 albums, and you had 2 hours of music on film. And I was like, oh, man, wow. And then I went home. I said, dang, 2 hours of music on film? That's a freaking lot of music, man.
Yeah, yeah. Well, typically, for many years, with the music factory years, And I'm writing a book about this, actually, currently. It's one of the things I'm doing in my spare time. I'm writing the book of squat, you know, because I'm a squattist. I don't know squat in the scheme of things, and I'm pretty sure that nobody else does either. So, but, you know, one of the things that is sort of astonishing is when you look back and you go, how did I even get all that done? You know, I must have delegated, and I did. I delegated a lot too. Like, you know, when I would write movie scores, for instance, I would write a theme and I would send the theme out to orchestrators and I'd say, make this theme hit these scenes. And they would send me a MIDI file, which I could then alter. Mm-hmm. And if it was way off the mark, I'd send it back to them and say, no, it's wrong because this. And eventually I got a really good set of orchestrators that helped us, you know, deal with bigger workloads. Mm. But we were doing, on average, about 20 hours of television a year and a dozen records. So wow. I don't even know how I did that, frankly.
Wow.
And I still had kids and stuff, too.
Yeah.
So I got that accomplished. I don't even remember. That's, you know, the thing about getting old is that I don't know if it's you lose the memory. It's that you have so much crammed up there.
Oh, yeah.
And you only have so much RAM speed. It takes too long to access it. Yeah. You can't access it properly.
Yeah, you got to download some of that stuff, man. erase some of that stuff off the hard drive.
Yeah. You know, it really became apparent to me. I was in Westport, and I was going on a friend's boat off the Cedar Point Yacht Club in Saugatuck Shores there. Mm-hmm. And we drove past somebody who I had worked with knew, and I couldn't remember his name. And he's like one of the few black guys in Westport. He's very famous. Mm. And I couldn't remember his name. And I said, well, I'll remember when I come back. You know, you can't just knock on somebody's door and say, hey, what's your name again? So it was Nile Rodgers. I mean, the River Nile, Rodgers. I mean, not remember that?
Wow.
You know, I couldn't remember. Mm-hmm. And so that sort of drove it home to me that, the memory isn't what it used to be. So now I actually use the calendar in my phone.
Oh, exactly. I have no, man, I'm sitting here right in front of me and I got, I have my, my daily planner and stuff. And, I know there's been studies done that say that if you write it down, that it helps to lock it in your brain and stuff, you know?
Yeah, that's probably true.
So,
yeah.
I've got
desks full of little pieces of paper that, like, you know, when I need to find the number, though, it would be like a 2-hour search, you know.
If I don't put it in my phone, a telephone number, it's a wrap, you know.
Well,
anybody gives me a car.
Fortunately, I have a partner that I've had since 2015, and and she's very organized, and Bonnie, and she basically is my brain storage unit.
Okay. That must have been who I talked to when I first called you. And I said, Brian left me a message to call him. You know, he's in the studio. He's recording. I think it was like an orchestra or something. I'm like, and he said, he's in the, look, he's working, man. Don't wait. No. If he told you that he wanted to speak to you, then he wants to speak to you. But he's working. Come on. He said, no.
Yeah, well, see, that's got the beauty of having your own schedule, you know, and being in charge is that you decide to make an orchestra wait and take a phone call.
That's what I'm saying.
Hey, they're getting paid. They don't care.
Oh, man. Family, Brian had so many good things to say, man, that we had to make this two parts. So please make sure that you tune in and check out part two of Brian Keene. In the meantime, y'all be blessed.